My name is Christina Groff, and I got involved in transpersonal psychology long before I knew the words, as a child who'd had unusual experiences that were part of my everyday life, as someone who's always been interested in mythology and art and literature and places that touch the same areas that transpersonal psychology refers to and talks about. One of the big stepping stones was that I studied with Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist, in college, and we became friends. He actually, during a difficult period in my life, introduced me to Stan. And the more I learned about the transpersonal world and the fact that someone had put words and concepts and thoughts around what I already had been experiencing and drawn to was very exciting to me. This was my introduction, and that was over 30 years ago. So I've been involved in one way or another in transpersonal ideas and transpersonal living since then. I get that question a lot when I, particularly when I speak groups that are involved in addiction and addiction recovery, where those are not particularly well-known words. And what I like to say is that it's a psychology that goes beyond what other psychologies have studied so very well. That includes the spiritual dimension of human beings, that there's the emotional, the physical, the mental, psychological, social aspects of a human being. But in order to really look at the whole person and treat the whole person and heal the whole person, that there needs to also be the spiritual element. I've seen resistance in various groups, and I have to remember that people put a lot of themselves, a lot of their time, their effort, their money into believing and reinforcing that belief in certain ways. And so anything that's new, anything that is unknown, is unacceptable or fear-producing often. But I'm really seeing the change happening, where more and more and more transpersonal ideas are being accepted. For example, in medical treatment of various diseases, in cardiac treatment, for example, the idea of using meditation as part of stress reduction. You know, they don't call it meditation necessarily. They might call it something like stress reduction or inner guided meditation guided imagery. But there's a gradual acceptance. What's called traditional psychology did a lot to allow transpersonal psychology to emerge, particularly in the West. I think transpersonal ideas and work and approaches have been part of humankind for many, many centuries. But in the West, anything that went beyond what was considered normal by society, by psychology, traditional psychology, was considered abnormal. I see transpersonal psychology as, in a way, not a new psychology, but going back to some of the old truths, that there is in order to treat a complete human being, there needs to be the spiritual aspect. I think a lot of the old psychologies or traditional psychologies focused on one particular aspect of human behavior or human functioning, and that transpersonal psychology has really a wide open theoretical perspective that includes and is interested in the whole variety of human behavior and human responses. Stan Grof and Esalen Institute, when we met there, Stan at the time was a scholar in residence at Esalen, living at Esalen. I was fairly newly divorced and looking for new horizons, a teaching job in California. I'd been a teacher of art and writing to children. Here was this amazing place, on really on the edge of the world, as it felt to me, where very dramatic things went on, very leading edge, exciting people were involved, very new experimental work was being done. And so Stan, once Stan and I fell in love, he opened his life to me, and I became involved in every aspect of, including our living together, our working together, our traveling together, and our creation of our work together. We were very fortunate during those early years to have Dick Price, who was the co-founder with Michael Murphy, living at Esalen. And Dick was a visionary. He was someone who was not afraid to take risks. He was someone who would go for the experiment. And if it failed, it failed. But it at least he was willing to kind of stay on that leading edge. There were also fascinating people who are now seen as kind of the elders of humanistic and transpersonal psychology, who were coming through, who were doing work there. It was a wonderful time in the 70s and the 80s. There were various spiritual leaders. Chogyam Trungpa came through, Lama Govinda came through, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. There were so many. Psychologists, Fritjof Capra, when he was in the early days, just after the Tao of Physics had been published, and the comparison between the mystical ideas and the findings in the new physics. Just a whole range of psychologists, people doing interesting work, and spiritual teachers. My interest in spiritual emergency, as it came to be known, began in childbirth. This was in the late 60s, and I had been practicing Hatha Yoga for some time quite intensely. As I look back on it, the breath and the movement and kind of the inner focus was very much like some of the practices of Lama's childbirth preparation, which I also was doing. There was no such thing then as yoga for pregnant women. And then when I got into the childbirth situation, and which is a very physically, emotionally, spiritually stressful situation, suddenly all hell broke loose, or all heaven broke loose. There was white light up my spine. There were electrical tremors, strange breathing that was being done through me or to me, an experience that I certainly was not prepared for, that I had not read about in any childbirth books. And the only way I had of understanding it at that time was to think that there was something terribly wrong. And in fact, I was given 2 shots of morphine as soon as my son was born. Same thing happened 2 years later when my daughter was born. And I, like the good girl that I was, managed to keep it down, whatever that was that had been awakened, until I met with my yoga class, met my spiritual teacher, Swami Luktananda, who was able to awaken what I learned was the Kundalini energy, the Shakti, in people through a look, through a touch, through just being in his presence. And when I met him, the lid blew off, and that was it. I was on a roller coaster that I could no longer control. For about 12 years, I was having experiences that really changed my world. There were many non-ordinary experiences that would just come on me unexpectedly as I went around about my daily life. I felt a lot as though I had 1 foot in this world and 1 foot in other worlds. I was totally, as a Westerner who'd been raised, you know, as a good girl in a middle class family, I was completely unprepared for this and terrified. And so I think my resistance was part of what made it take so long. I was with Stan for some of the last part of this experience, and suddenly hearing about transpersonal psychology and entering that world, I had a framework to put around it, that this might not be pathological experience that I was having, but maybe it was something that was transformative, that would be a positive outcome in the end. There were 2 periods during those 12 years in which I completely lost hold of this reality and went for a period of days into it could be described as a prolonged, people who've had psychedelics would say it was like a prolonged LSD experience. I was just completely in another world and needed 24-hour care, and there were experiences coming from all areas of my unconscious. And I, with a great deal of support, I learned to kind of just go with it. out of my own experience with the Kundalini awakening, I learned that there was a context for this experience that I had had, spiritual emergency, that there was a certain pattern of experiences in the body, in my inner experience, that fit a certain form that had been written about by many people coming from India in particular, and it was called the Kundalini experience. I had studied about it with Joseph Campbell, but I never dreamed that it was something that a Western housewife could experience. And in thinking about what this was that had happened to me, I became very interested in whether there are other people who have such non-ordinary experiences spontaneously, who are automatically treated as psychiatric patients. That there were times, if I had not had the support that Stan and some of our friends offered, and the transpersonal understanding that this might be something that was evolutionary or transformative, I'm sure I would have ended up hospitalized. So I became interested in what is the line between someone who has true mental disease and someone who is having a dramatic, difficult period of transformation. And so this is where the whole idea of spiritual emergency came from. Is there a subcategory of people who are automatically thrown into the bag of psychotic, who are really going through a difficult stage in a transformation process? From the outside, it can look very dramatic and be very dramatic during the most intense periods. But it also is the possibility of emerging from this kind of small self-identification. You know, I began when I was born, I'll end when I die. You know, I live in this small ego defined being. This brought me into a whole new awareness of who I was, that I was much bigger and more interconnected than with the rest of consciousness than I ever considered. So I began a network of people in 1980 called the Spiritual Emergency Network. It turned into the Spiritual Emergence Network, that is still going on internationally, that offers help to people who are who know that they're not psychotic, that they're not mental patients, or therapists who will know that whoever they're working with deserves support through their experience rather than being hospitalized, labeled, tranquilized in their experience. Holotropic breathwork is a combination of elements. First, it's an experiential form of self-exploration. Some people use it as part of the therapy that they already do as psychologists. But we like to call it a form of self-exploration. We discovered it kind of by accident, where we had a large group of people coming to work with us, and Stan had hurt his back, and we always would work with one person at a time if someone became emotionally involved in our groups. And so when Stan hurt his back and we had 40 people that we were going to work with for 5 days. We said, you know, what do we do about the experiential part of it? And we said, okay, let's let them work with each other. And so we did. And we said, okay, we'll ask them to do a little bit deeper breathing than usual. And knowing that breath is a vehicle that have, in many cultures, brought about, kind of loosened the defenses and brought the unconscious to the conscious awareness. And people had such a great time, we just continued from there. It's a combination of breath and we prepare people with a very open theoretical framework that there is a vast possibility within the psyche, and that there's kind of an inner healer within each person that knows what needs to come up on a certain day, what needs to be seen and dealt with and recognized. We ask people to divide into partners. One person during a session is the breather, and the other person sits with them, which is a very important role to kind of provide support for that, for the breather, to keep them safe, to keep them warm if they need a blanket. And then I will do a relaxation exercise to get people sort of quiet and beginning to breathe lightly, and then we'll lead them into deeper and faster breathing, and we put on some supportive music. And many people end up having all kinds of experiences. It can be an altered state, very profound. Some people go into spiritual experiences very rapidly. Other people, their biographical experiences that will come up that they deal with. There's a lot of emotion, a lot of expression involved. We'll work with people who need help kind of moving through a very emotional experience. People can have past life type of experiences, identification with an animal. We've seen people feel the identification with the whole of humanity. A whole range, whatever is possible in the human experience is available. Well, throughout centuries, again, breath has been used in many cultures as a way to get into non-ordinary states of consciousness, whether it's through healing rituals, whether it is in trance inducing movement and music, and I'm thinking of the Sufis, or some kind of African ritual where there's breath that's involved. It weakens the defenses. It brings up whatever is present in the psyche on that particular day. And there are certain cultures that will just breathe through whatever comes up. And the sort of end result is a very powerful, visual, non-ordinary state, not unlike the hallucinogenics that that Stan worked with in his early years as a researcher of non-ordinary states. People who've had both, have had the breath work and have also had psychedelics, have said often that they're very similar. So I don't know. Stan's the scientist. I don't know all the mechanisms that actually will bring up the psyche, but it works. And we've seen over and over again, we're always surprised, seen over and over again, people bringing experiences that we would never have predicted. When I was about 6 months sober, I ran into a letter that Carl Gustav Jung, the great Swiss psychiatrist, had written to Bill Wilson, who was the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that letter, Jung was writing about one of his alcoholic patients. And he said something along the lines of, the thirst of the alcoholic for alcohol is on a deep level the thirst of the soul for wholeness or union with God. And when I read that, this is it. You know, there was more than the physical, emotional, psychological aspects of addiction for me. There was also a deep, deep spiritual longing that I've always had, ever since I was a kid, that suddenly had some verification from Jung's words. And so I decided to study that, to talk to other people, to find out what their experiences were. And I began to realize that there was a very deep connection between the spiritual yearning. I believe that there is a deep spiritual yearning that is the deepest a part of the addictive craving. And that in order to fully treat and address addictions, that the spiritual aspects of people must be taken into account. The 12-step programs, AA as the first one, knew that. The founders knew that, they talk about a higher power and the need for a higher power. But a lot of the addiction treatment facilities and professionals didn't quite know what to do with that part of healing from and recovery from addictions. There was the treatment center I went to. There was a very uncomfortable about half hour discussion of the difference between religion and spirituality, and that was it, where I believe that it needs to be a real central aspect, along with the need to look into family patterns and, you know, genetic disposition and emotional components and physiological components. I mean, all the work that's been done in the addictions world is been very, very useful. If I have to be an alcoholic, I'm so glad that I am one now. I wouldn't recommend it to anyone, but if I have to be, this is a good period because there's been so much good work. This is one of the things that I've been trying to do in these last 20 years is to bridge the transpersonal world and the addiction world, because in the addiction world, there really isn't the transpersonal language. In a way, they're existing in a parallel, doing this similar work, but in very parallel kind of universes. Certainly what I see in people in recovery, there's some of the most loving, creative, sensitive, inventive people that I know. I've met a lot of Buddhas along the way, and you know, sitting in funky recovery groups in the basement of some church or community center in various countries, and people who live in a transpersonal way, but might not have the terminology to describe it that way. I've been, you know, hoping that some of the addiction treatment professionals could learn from what's already been developed and researched and written about in the transpersonal world, and could learn from that in sort of broadening their understanding of who their clients are. And I think the transpersonal world could learn something about addictions. Well, I think that the idea that Jung put forth, that there's a deep craving in humankind for connection with our larger selves, our deeper selves, if we put it that way, is interesting from a kind of global community perspective. I wrote a paper some time ago called Elephants in the Global Living Room. You know, what are the problems in the when families are talking about the problem with an addict, they will often talk about the elephant in the living room. What are all of the issues that we're not addressing, and we tiptoe around every day in our everyday lives, but we don't really address this giant beast that's standing right in the midst. And I wrote a paper called The Elephant in the Global Living Room, or The Whole Herd of Elephants in the Global Living Room. What are the global addictions? I've been interested in looking at, if you take the journey of an individual addict with a transpersonal overview, including the spiritual dimension, that there's this larger yearning that, and apply it to where we find ourselves as a human community. What are our global addictions? There's addiction to dogma. There's addiction to consumerism, to land, to country, to oil, to weapons, there's addiction to superiority, to you know, anything you can think of. And is there any possibility that we as a global community are going to be forced to take a look at what it is that we're doing and this incredibly dysfunctional behavior that is spiraling us as a human community further and further down towards some sort of a bottom. And you often hear people say, I'm afraid we'll wipe ourselves out. I'm afraid we will destroy the planet and everything, every living thing on it. And my feeling about the global addictions is that if millions of nasty, you know, addictive behavior is awful to be around. You know, if millions of nasty, profane, you know, what's the word? Sort of disheveled, disgusting, leches, you know, addicts can turn themselves around, or can be turned around through the grace of their higher power then I believe our world can do the same. Our human community can do the same. Stan Grof is the love of my life. He is, you know, the world sees him as a brilliant man. He has an encyclopedic mind. He has been a dutiful, dedicated researcher, and his passion for non-ordinary states has changed the lives of many, many people. I've seen him as a father to my children. I have children from another marriage, and he knew them from the time that they were very small, and he's been an amazing and loving father and now grandfather. He's one of the most patient people I've ever met. He is a cartoonist, and one of the sad things about our house burning down was I lost a lot of the cartoons that he'd given me over the years for birthday and Christmas cards. His work, I believe, is something that I don't know whether he'll ever get the recognition that he deserves, but I know that it's been a major contribution and continues to be to the field of transpersonal psychology and also to the opening up of the understanding of the human psyche in general, that he was able to go from being a strict Freudian to he's a very curious and adventurous person to this day. And because of that curiosity, he tried the sample of LSD that was sent to his research lab in the mid-50s in Prague, and was able to make the leap from being a Freudian to being excited and curious enough about the possibilities of understanding the human mind through this tool he started there and hasn't stopped. It continues. He's someone who's very childlike in many ways. Full of wonderment when we are walking in nature, and one of the most heartful, loving people that I ever met.